better if I turn it on, won't it? All right. Well, it's good to see each one here this evening, and we're going to be looking at Matthew 5. I hope we can finish up 38 through 48 this evening. If we don't, we'll carry it over and finish it up Sunday morning. That's just the way. We've got a little slack built into this quarter, so I'm really, really hoping I can stay pretty much on track, finish, and have a couple extra class periods, because when I have that, I unleash Bible review on the class, and nothing is off limits. You know, I fire questions at you, you know. So, having said that, some of you will start trying to drag me and slow me down, you know. But no, no high pressure to it at all. But I'm hoping we have a chance to do that, because it's always something I think people enjoy and find profitable. Before we get started, Rodney, would you mind leading us in prayer, please? All right. As we continue this study, it just keeps coming to my mind that there are a lot of passages of Scripture that present great challenges to us, that, you know, that call upon us to do things that go against sometimes our natural inclinations, that, you know, fight. But I don't know anywhere where you put more challenges close together than in the Sermon on the Mount. You know, when you begin to look at this sermon, and it just starts off by challenging us to say, I'm nothing. You know, to be poor in spirit, to admit one's need to be filled by God, that, you know, we're empty. We're hungering and thirsting for righteousness, that, you know, we know that we develop the character God wants us to, which, you know, is so, takes such effort, and then what happens? The world turns against us. But then we're not allowed to run from the world. We have to remain in this world and be its salt and be its light. You see how unnatural that is. That you think, you know, why work for something so hard that people aren't going to appreciate? And then if people aren't going to appreciate it, you know, at least it's like, well, forget you. No, he said, we're the salt and the earth. And then he goes on, he begins starting at verse 21, which is the section we're in, these contrast, which I believe primarily verse 20, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. You know, that's what we've got to exceed. We've got to exceed it by saying, you know, I'm not going to be filled with hatred. I'm not going to speak evil words against others. Yes, I'm going to be, you know, he uses the husband here, and it would apply to the wife. He said, I'm going to be loyal to my wife, not committing adultery. No, I'm going to be far beyond that. I'm going to be loyal in my heart. It will be pure. You know, we can look at other passages on divorce that may give other reasons. But here, he says, we're going to reject divorce because it's unloving. We would cause our wife to commit adultery. We'd cause a third party to commit adultery. We're rejecting it because it's a lack of love. We're committing ourselves to be truthful. We don't have to be under oath. You know, nobody has to make us cross our heart and hope to die, you know, as we'd say as kids. We just tell the truth. And so, those are great challenges. And it's not going to get any easier tonight. And some of you are sitting there thinking, he forgot the memory passage tonight, right? Well, since I have to be honest, I did. Till I started reading part of it. Matthew 5 and verse 16, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Matthew 5:20, for I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. All right. When you get to 38 through 48, it's not getting easier, for sure. It's difficult. And in fact, it involves at times some controversies. And I just want to say, first of all, we can't be afraid of texts that create difficulties and that brethren have understood differently. We just have to deal with them. Deal with them in the right spirit. And study with an open mind. You know, listen carefully to what others say, what they think. You know, sometimes, you know, I know I've been asked questions, and over the years, I've gotten better. I will not say that I've yet, as Paul, you know, borrow the words of Paul from a different situation, not that I have already attained, I'm already made perfect, but somebody would ask a question in a class. I was going to answer the question right then. You know, or, you know, somebody challenged. Well, then, the debate goes, I've gotten a little better over the years at saying, you know, I don't know. Next class, we'll talk about that some more. And I'm saying that to say, don't be afraid to take it and chew on it a little while. Sometimes, after you have thought about it and meditated on it and worked it over and considered you'll end up right where you started. You know, it'll confirm, well, I think I was right to begin with. But at least work through the process of going through it. Now, in this passage, I'm going to give you my approach, just kind of a suggested approach. I don't believe that every statement in 38 through 48 is meant to be taken in an absolute, literal way that, you know, to just take, that in every situation one literally turns the other cheek, you know, or gives up his tunic or his cloak. Having said that I don't think it necessarily is literal in every way, I think we have to really work that we don't end up just explaining it away. You know, that where it ends up meaning very little, if anything. You know, that we must not make the mistake of the Pharisees who, they brought the law down to themselves. We've got to raise ourselves to whatever it says. Now, if it means it in a literal way, then let's do that. If there is a figurative or a principle involved, let's rise to the principle. Let's just make sure we're not getting away from what it, you know, actually says, what it teaches. Sunday, what we talked about was, I just got into it and then the bell rang. I think this is rooted in the teaching of the law and prophets. One reason for that is the fact that it's introduced by saying you have to exceed the scribes and Pharisees. But in Matthew 7 and verse 12, when Jesus states what we've come to call the golden rule, he said this is the law and the prophets. In Luke 6, what we call the golden rule is inserted right in the middle of this discussion of turning the other cheek, loving your enemy. Jesus said the principle of the golden rule is found in the Old Testament. The root of it is there. And Luke puts it right there. But I want you to understand, as we've said several times, the root is in the Old Testament. But it flowers into something much grander, much larger, much higher. And in many, yes, demanding, but ultimately more beautiful than what was there. And I think the other thing I wanted to make mention, I believe what we have in this passage is the Pharisees took Old Testament teaching, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, that in its original Old Testament context two contexts, had two purposes. It was to make sure judges were neither too lenient nor too harsh. You know, if a man took a life, the judge was not to let him off with, you know, 10 lashes. But if a man got into a, you know, he, you know, jumped on his neighbor and knocked his tooth out, the principle eye for an eye, tooth for tooth meant the punishment would fit the crime. The Jews seemed to have, some of them, had taken this to be a personal right of vengeance. And having said, let's read the verses and see what Jesus says. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you. And from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Now I want you to turn, if you would, a little differently tonight. I want you to turn to Luke 6. And I want to read the comparable section in Luke 6, starting at verse 27. What I want you to know, the order is a little different, and the wording is a little different at times, and it can be helpful to us. But I say to you who hear, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you, and pray for those who spitefully use you. To him who strikes you on the one cheek, offer the other also. And from him who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. Give to everyone who asks of you, and from him who takes away your goods, do not ask them back. And just as you want men to do to you, you also do to them likewise. But if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? For even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much back. But love your enemies. Do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the unthankful and evil. Therefore be merciful, just as your Father also is merciful. And you might notice, in Luke's account, he immediately goes to the judge not. That in Matthew will be all the way to chapter 7, but that's for another discussion at another time. Okay, here we go. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth. I tell you not to resist an evil person. Question 7. Is that intended to be absolute, that we don't offer any resistance of any kind to evil people? No. Are there examples of people in the New Testament, good people, offering resistance to evil of some kind? All right. Mm-hmm. He, Jesus, in essence, rebuked the man. Paul did. I think those are two good examples. In fact, I might have them up there. This is a different one, and I didn't put the one that Brother Huggins mentioned in the whitewashed sepulcher. But in a sense, Paul resisted by telling, you know, he didn't just go along with it. Brother Paul? And even, I guess, you know, what I'm wanting us to see is that don't resist is not, you know, not that there's no way. You know, when Paul was slapped on the other cheek, he didn't say, hey, hit me one more time, you know. Literally, neither did Jesus. When they were plotting to take and kill Paul, he got, you know, his nephew said, go tell the captain, you know, we're going to try to get around this thing if we can help it. But what I think we need to see in all of these is none of them. Jesus, yes, he rebuked the man, but he didn't strike the man back. Paul, he rebuked the high priest, but he didn't fight back. When Peter took the sword, what were Jesus' words to Peter? Put it up. Those who take the sword, what? Die by the sword. That no one ever took personal vengeance. I really think that what Jesus is doing is using some very arresting words to make the point that Paul is making in Romans 12. That we don't repay evil with what? Evil. Our enemy's hungry, what do? We feed him. If he's thirsty, we give him a drink. You know, we do positive good for him. You know, there is a, I'm using that word resist. Yes, there's a measure of resistance, but vengeance belongs to whom? Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. You know, God sometimes repays directly, and that we know the day is coming, a day of vengeance in which God will, you know, bring vengeance. Romans 13, God does take vengeance. You know, the authorities are his minister to punish evil, to execute wrath. At the end of the 12th chapter, and remember there were no chapter divisions when Paul wrote the letter, he says, you don't avenge yourself. Now, you know, there are courts. You know, there are laws in place that may punish evil, but it's not your place to avenge evil. I want you to see something in 1 Corinthians 6. And I'm bringing up Romans 12, and 13, I guess, and 1 Corinthians 6, because I think in some ways they are the commentaries. They are the, as the apostles go out and they teach and they preach, they're teaching what Jesus taught. In 1 Corinthians 6, you remember brother was taking brother to law, and, you know, he gives them several reasons not to do this, but starting at verse 6, but brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers. Now therefore, it is already an utter failure for you that you go to law against one another. Catch the rest of this. Why do you not rather accept wrong? Why do you not rather let yourselves be cheated No, you yourselves do wrong and cheat, and you do these things to your brethren. Here in 1 Corinthians 6, and I think if you read the first 8 verses all together, he said, your conduct, and the root of this is self. My brother did me wrong. Well, I'll take him to court. He said, look, you're doing this before unbelievers. What does this look like to the world? And what Paul said is it would have been better for you to have been cheated. If you suffered a wrong, you've done a wrong. Never, ever do wrong because somebody else does. You know, don't be driven to, you know, back at the beginning of the chapter, to hatred, to angry words. You know, I mean, in a moment, he's going to lift it up and say it even more. You're going to have to love him. I mean, it starts off by saying, you know, here's this mean rascal that wants to hit you. And he does hit you. Okay? It's one thing to tell me, don't hit him back. And then he turns around and he says, and love him. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself, but, you know, if we want to take 38 through 42, as I've already said, I'm not saying it's a absolute literal. If the guy strikes you on the cheek, I don't have any objection to closing the door and, you know, going in the house before he hits me the second time, you know. But he's saying, you don't do wrong. And it's going to get harder in the next part. No. That's great. I hope everybody could hear what Brother Huggins was saying about our attitude of the humility. The first teaching is blessed are the poor in spirit. If I am puffed up with pride, you know, I mean, why do injuries hurt us so much? We start saying, well, can you believe what he did to me? You know, and then we start, and we'll use, I don't deserve this, and, you know. And a lot of I's and me's get involved. And the truth, I mean, surely you didn't deserve that. But Jesus is saying, forget yourself. Mm-hmm. If we've got love, that's right. I think that's so good, true. Let's get another one of these before we haven't even got to the love, actually. But I want to, you know, notice the statement. I mean, it's just a, you know, give to him who asks you. Marshall, you? Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. Okay, I think we got two things going here. In the first eight verses, the way I understand 1 Corinthians 6, I think I get where you're going. 1 Corinthians 6, 1 through 8, he's dealing with, they were taking one another to court, there were some issues, and he said, look, you know, that's wrong. He gives them several reasons. One, you're doing this before the world, you know, it's reflecting. You know, it's better that you accept the wrong. I think verses 9 and 10 are intended to follow that up by saying, look, if you practice unrighteousness, you're not going to inherit the kingdom of God. Then he reminds them, that was your life, but it's not anymore. The whole chapter is trying to get them to live right. And he says, if you do these things, and one of them is covetous and reviling, those are the kind of things that go on in a court, he said, you're not going to go to heaven. But he said, that's the life you put away once. You once put that away to be washed. That's baptism. Sanctified when God makes you holy. Justified, God pronounced them not guilty. No, there's no vengeance for those who go through those steps. You know, but I think he's warning them. He said, you're in danger of backing up, you know, and don't make that mistake. So that's how I see that. You know, that they had been wicked, and he said, you got God's forgiveness. Don't go back. Don't back up and start, you know, going to court with your brother and doing these things. And then he's going to continue right in the next couple of verses and start talking about sexual immorality, fornication. He said, don't do that. You quit that once. Don't be trapped back in it again. Does that make sense? Hopefully. Well, sometimes, you know, I will say this. One of the difficult, our Bible's divided into chapters and verses. It sometimes can break up thoughts, but there's also this to be said for, and it's, I think it's important, try to catch the thought of a paragraph, a chapter, you know. But let's say this about Paul. There are not a lot of things Paul and I have in common, you know, but we can interrupt ourselves sometimes and go off on a tangent. And you got to watch Paul. He'll jump off on a tangent before he comes back, but in general, there will be a flow. Yes. There were, There, even for the forgiven, there can be consequences that stay with us. That is, yeah, that can happen. That can be. I think that I wouldn't eliminate that part of it. I think, you know, that when God says, you know, what He's trying to tell us is, you leave it to Me. You know, a lot of times it happens in this life. It happens in this life through natural causes. I mean, a drunkard destroys his own life. You know, he suffers his punishment, you know, because of the disease and, you know, he wrecks his health. There are laws, as Romans 13 says, the government bears the sword. And then there's the great day of judgment coming. You know, that's the ultimate. But, you know, I don't limit God's vengeance to any one thing. I just know He says, you let Me take care of it. Yeah, I agree. I'm with you. I'm with you. Let's go back to 9. Let's get a little bit more, because it all ties together. You know, he makes a statement: give to him who asks you. From him who wants to borrow, do not turn away. And I think if we would take a passage like 2 Thessalonians 3:10, if a man won't work, neither should he eat. And we recognize there might be somebody that asks, and we say, no. Get out here and get to work. He's not telling us under every circumstance that could be imagined. You know, I don't want us, though, the fact that we understand, he doesn't mean it in every single situation, that it ends up being almost no situation. You know, Brother Earnhardt, any of the rest of you ever find you have to grab a dictionary once in a while? You know, he's got quite a vocabulary. But he also has some really earthy expressions, too. He says, don't try to make this walk on all fours. I thought that was a great way of putting it, which is his way of saying, you know, these are illustrations where Jesus says it in an intentionally strong way to get our attention. He's not meaning here that there will never be a situation where somebody asks for money and you don't say no. I mean, a man standing outside a liquor store, you know, and says, can I have $20? Well, no. You know, and that's not what Jesus meant. But he wants to get our attention that it's better to give. Somebody is suing you to take away your tunic. He said, give him your cloak. And I think what he's saying is the principle of 1 Corinthians 6. You know, it's better to do that than you let this hatred and resentment build up in your heart and you're going to go to court and you're going to fight him and you're going to... Jesus, go ahead and give him another piece of cloak. The man, verse 41, whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. From what I can read, this started way back in the time of the Persians, you know, about the time of Queen Esther and such. The Persians had this courier system where they kind of like our post office, but they were entitled to grab a man and just say, look, you will take this for me. And the Romans had carried this custom over. A Roman soldier could grab anybody that wasn't a Roman citizen. Citizens were exempted, and say, you'll carry this equipment a mile, which was 1,000 paces, you know. And Jesus said, go with him too. Is he saying, again, I don't think he was literal, but he's saying it would be better to walk 2 miles with that man for than you to be going along. I mean, you're by law, you have to do it or he can cut your head off. Be going along the whole time, I hate these Romans. I wish we could run these Romans out of this country. He said, just go to. Carry it. Do this. Don't become like them. Don't become like your enemy is the point. Follow the golden rule. I'm way behind on my clicking, aren't I? The golden, do treat people the way you want to be treated. And I'll say this. So often we think of the golden rule. And I don't want to eliminate, if a man's hungry, he needs a sandwich right now. You know. But the greatest good we can ever do for anybody is spiritual good. And, you know, and that's why if a man asks me for money to buy alcohol, I'm not doing him good. If I were embarked on that course of life, I would want somebody to stop me. You know, I would want to be, you know, halted in that. You know, I know I haven't answered every question you might have on this. But I want us to look at the next section, because you just can't get the one without the other. The progression. You know, verse 39 is, don't resist an evil person. Slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other. And now he progresses and he says, how about this? We're going to love our enemies. We're going to not just not do something, we're going to do something positive. That's reaching upward. You know, you look at 43 and 44, and, you know, I raised the question, and I think the answer to this question is a complicated one myself. When I read things like, you know, obviously they were to love their neighbor, but, you know, they went in and they wiped out a people. I mean, they exterminated the Canaanites. You know, what are sometimes referred to as the imprecatory psalms, the ones that call down vengeance on others. You know, that might lead you to believe, okay, it's okay to hate your enemy. Then you read in a passage like, you know, Exodus 23. If you come along and you see your enemy's animal under a burden, he said, you better help that up. The words of Romans 12, if your enemy is hungry, feed him, are from Proverbs 25. And what about Jonah? Jonah hated his enemies. I don't know why. I'm pretty sure nobody told me this as a child, but I had the picture Jonah didn't want to go to Nineveh because he was afraid of the Ninevites. You know, and he was afraid, you know, that here comes this Jew preaching to them and they're going to... The reason he didn't want to go to Nineveh is he was afraid he would be a success. He was afraid they would listen to him. He wanted that city destroyed. And he got mad when he went there and they repented. You imagine that. Jonah didn't like the people of Nineveh. And that was wrong. So, what do we have? Well, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. agree. Let me just say this as one last. I want to hit this Old Testament one last thing, and then we're going to quit. You remember when Jesus said, "Love your neighbor"? What would the man said? Well, who is my neighbor? They'd reached the point they didn't even know who their neighbor was. You know, I believe the attitude that God expected was different than what they had. But what he calls us to is a lot higher. Quickly. Enemies. Yeah, that's right. And Sunday morning, we're going to finish up chapter 5. We